Hello and welcome to the Euractiv Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News Team. So we're here today with Euractiv's very own Clara. Hello, Clara. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us today. So we've invited you on to have a little chat about this report that was published this week on something called the Polluter Pays Principle. Maybe you could give a little summary. What does this principle mean? What is this about?
The Polluter Pays Principle is well established in the EU and aims to hold responsible polluters for the pollution they cause. So in other words, the polluter and not the taxpayer is expected to bear the costs created by pollution.
Right, so it's the ones that are putting the pollution out into the environment that then has to pay, which kind of makes sense, I suppose, because it's trying to stem the source of pollution. And this is something it's established, it's in environmental policy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so what was the report this week from the auditors about this? What were the kind of main conclusions from this report?
Well, the main conclusion in the latest report of the EU Court of Auditors reveals that actually European taxpayers often foot a hefty bill because according to the ECA, the PPP, does not cover all cases and its application can be different from one sector to another or from one country to another.
So basically in different places in the EU, it's being applied not evenly and not fairly, presumably.
Not fairly.
And what I thought was interesting about this report was that it was talking about the need to apply the polluter pays principle to the agricultural sector, to water, which is kind of like a merge of our two hubs. We're talking about environment and agriculture and kind of becoming one.
Just for the water pollution or?
Yeah, so they were talking about it specifically in water pollution.
Mm.
But the other day as well, there was another, I mean, I think actually maybe our loyal listeners will remember we had actually one of the auditors on a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about the polluter pays principle in terms of greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture as well. So actually there's been multiple kind of conversations about applying it to the agricultural sector in different ways, from different angles. But this report specifically was focusing on water pollution, saying that it was the sector that kind of exerted the most pressure on water resources and that they should be the ones to pay.
Yeah, I mean, I assume there's also, other issues like, of course, waste management and all this kind of stuff that even, incidentally touch on agriculture too. But yeah, it seems that water resources and pollution of water resources is probably the most pressing, together with the greenhouse emission, of course. But I mean, it's a bit more difficult to assess this principle when it comes to greenhouse emission. I don't know. I mean, I'm just assuming.
It's difficult for water as well because it's really, really diffuse, and it's a really diffuse kind of issue. And so it's very difficult to say who's done what where. And they did highlight that in the report, that it was incredibly difficult to apply this to the agricultural sector.
You know what this water pollution reminds me of? Of our great time with Mark Ruffalo.
Oh.
Because, I mean, the movie. Okay.
Clara, we have a story for you.
A bit of context,
I think I need a bit of context.
Yeah. Last year was before the pandemic.
Okay.
Was one of the, of our last, trip to the European Parliament. So they invited, I don't remember who, probably an NGO, could be the EEB. They invited the actor, Mark Ruffalo, to present this Dark Waters, which is a very good movie. And was about water pollution, if I remember.
It was, yes. I actually watched the movie. It was a good movie. Yeah. I'm not paid to advertise it, but it's a good movie.
So, okay. And basically it was, we started the podcast. It was like, we were at the fourth or fifth episodes of the podcast. And I had this brilliant idea of having Mark Ruffalo on the record say something agriculture, whatever. So we went there just to ask a question on agriculture to Mark Ruffalo in order to...
Two questions. Do you remember?
To have him on the podcast, you know. And it was like an incredible attempt, which failed ultimately. And I was so close because they gave me the floor in a committee meeting, you know, in a committee room. But actually, they gave the floor to some kind of president of this this organization. And in the end, the time was over. And
that would have been great.
I know. Can you imagine? Your heart was broken, wasn't it?
And there were other attempts I'm not particularly proud of.
I wonder what Mark Ruffalo would make of the polluter pays principle. Do you think he would be for it?
Mark, if you listen to us, I'm sure you're listening. Tell us what's your take on the polluter pays principle.
So what were you saying? It was interesting about water pollution.
Yeah, so I was saying that usually when you speak of pollution or tackle pollution in the EU or basically anywhere else in the world, you don't really think of what pollution first. It's usually about the industrial sector, transport, or waste management as well. So I think it's very good that on Monday in the report, the ECA has decided to focus more on water pollution and agriculture.
Yeah, it is interesting because you're right, it's not the one that you immediately think of, but obviously agriculture has such a big impact on water, on the water tables and on, you know, nitrate pollution and fertilizers and water use. So it has a huge effect and it's something that maybe slips under the radar sometimes.
And when you think of it, water is really, I mean, water policies and how to manage water resources that we have to keep it clean and without any kind of pollution is really important, not only for agriculture, but also for health, safety, all of this. So I think, yeah, it's really important that they've decided to focus more on water and agriculture, which is a big sector. In France, for example, we have a very strong agriculture industry. So I think it's a good opportunity.
And actually, because they cited a study, the auditors, talking about the price of water, the price of this water pollution, they were saying it can cost up to 494 euros per household per year in France.
That we paid. French people pay.
I was going to say, not us, poor Clara. It's Clara's paying. Sorry, Clara. Per household per year in France for the most affected regions, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, that's huge. I've read this number as well. I was really surprised because I wouldn't imagine how water can cost to taxpayers or even to France. So yeah, I think that's good that they've decided to tackle this issue.
Yeah, when you put a concrete figure on things like that, it's it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, you just realize when you see the figures.
So thanks, Clara, for your expertise on this matter. And let's follow, actually, all the developments on the implementation of this principle. Of course, on Euractiv France and euractiv.com in the environment section and agriculture section.
Also, actually, what was quite interesting about this call to apply the polluter pays principle to agriculture is that the commissioner, the agricultural commissioner, Janusz Wojciechowski, seemed really favourable to this. So I asked him about this week during a press conference, and he said he fully agreed with the conclusions of the report. And he said that the polluter pays principle should be visible in agricultural policy. He took note of the fact that, you know, there are differences between different member states and the effort needs to be proportional, the scale of the problems. But in general, he gave this really positive response to this idea of making this principle apply to agriculture. And obviously, you know, to say that, I think it goes without saying, obviously this means that the farmers themselves or the farming community or the farming sector themselves, depending on what, you know, what area you're in, will be the ones shouldering the burden for this pollution. And this was backed by the commissioner. So I think it's safe to say that's probably going to be a little bit controversial.
But just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I actually did reach out to the Farmers Association Copa Cogeca, but they weren't willing to comment at the moment. But it'll be interesting to see how this kind of develops in the future and what the response will be to this once it's maybe been considered a little bit more, because the auditors did point out that it's enormously difficult to apply this principle to agriculture for a number of reasons, because the pollution's really diffuse, because it's hard to say who's doing what and where, and also because the water's not treated, so you know they're not having a direct kind of cost associated with it. So there's obviously a lot of issues that need ironing out maybe before you get anywhere near to actually applying this principle in agriculture. The fact that he was open to it was fully agreed with it, actually, that's even stronger.
There are also some legal problems. I'm sure our listeners, some of our listeners won't agree, but yeah, it's a bit difficult to establish a certain degree of responsibility. Okay, when we're talking about big multinational and all this kind of stuff, but you know, if you put the burden basically on small or mid-sized farmers, might be a bit.
It's a very different story, really.
Yeah, it's a different story, and again, it's not only, you know, when it comes to who's going to pay, but also establish who's responsible for certain actions in when it comes to agriculture. Of course, I mean, it's maybe easier if you have a company that is basically polluting the air with emissions and so on. Maybe it could be a bit more difficult when it comes, for instance, water sources and agriculture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the auditors also pointed out that it's really challenging to apply this to agriculture, also because it's not strictly an environmental policy. And, you know, policy, the principle only applies to environmental policies, but they pointed out that agriculture creates a lot of pollution but pays relatively little, and so they said that it's vital to try and address this. And actually, they have called on the commission to they added a kind of specific recommendation to the commission to consider how to deal with this issue and to look at the kind of overall cost benefits of applying the principle to the agricultural sector by the end of 2024, so in a few years time.
Let's see. They might have the agriculture commissioner on board, but maybe some
things might change in between.
No, at least some suspicion from the commission's legal service.
Well.
And we are here also with another very own journalist of Euractiv.
Proper Euractiv party, this podcast.
Yeah. Actually, Euractiv France.
Yes.
We are here with Magdalena. You may remember her for her very good AgriFood brief last week. So you already know her name.
And now you'll know her voice.
Yeah. And now you'll hear exactly her voice. Hi, Magdalena. How's it going?
Hi. Nice. Thank you very much. And thanks for the very flattering introduction.
Yeah. Of course.
Why you're here, of course, to speak about bubbles. Okay. So basically what happened between France and Russia this week. But tell us a bit more what happened.
So actually, we're talking about a real bubble war. So what happened is that Vladimir Putin, so the Russian president, adopted an amendment to the Russian law on alcoholic beverages that now only allows Russian sparkling wine producers to actually put the name champagne on their bottles, whereas the true champagne producers, which are the French, will have to call their true champagne sparkling wine.
I assume French people aren't that happy about what's happened.
Not at all, obviously. So we have strong reactions, notably from the French Champagne Committee, which is obviously outraged at the Russian announcement and which is calling all French champagne producers to stop exporting their produce to Russia.
That's an interesting development because, of course, I mean, the economic relationship between Russia and the EU are not super good since the annexation of Crimea. There's still an embargo, and actually, basically every summer there's this talk of lifting this embargo, actually promoted by countries like Italy, France, and Germany, while Eastern countries are a bit more suspicious. Do you know if there's an agreement of mutual recognition of geographical indication between the EU and Russia?
Not from what I gathered. So I asked the commission and they told me that no, there was no such agreement. Mm-hmm. So on the private side, the Champagne Committee is actually working with partners, and they said they were working with Russian champagne or sparkling wine producers like for the last 20 years to actually get to a mutual recognition or mm-hmm. at least a sort of respect. But no, there is no such thing as a mutual recognition between the EU and Russia on champagne.
That's an interesting aspect because, I mean, for instance, in March, you remember, Natasha, there was this agreement with China on a mutual recognition of products, of GIs, basically. And that's why the eAmbrosia database where all the GIs are listed, has been recently filled with Chinese GIs. It's off topic, but they even managed to get a PGI, a protected geographic indication, for a kind of pasta, which is quite difficult in the EU. I mean, for instance, there are only...
Were the Italians outraged in this
case? No. Because, no. There are, if I'm not wrong, there are 13, including the pasta, the Chinese pasta.
The Chinese actually invented pasta.
That's a long-standing issue. But yeah, so for instance, I think five from Italy, like Pizzoccheri, Della Valtellina, Pasta di Gragnano. It's quite tough to get a PGI for pasta, and again, Chinese managed to register these. You know, this vermicelli made from bean starch, you know? It's like the...
Of course, you've got such a niche knowledge of all the GIs of pasta.
I have a Chinese wholesale food market next to my house. And, you know, the glass noodle, no? So they're completely see-through. I don't remember the Chinese name, though. But, yeah, so
anymore?
Again... this mutual recognition is actually quite helpful in order to establish this environment of trust between two blocks, two economic bloc, and two partners. Because I mean, Russia is still he's a neighbor country, so yeah.
Not a lot of neighborly love here. Not if you go for something like champagne. I mean, that's,
yeah,
is hitting the French right in the core where it hurts, you know.
A last question, Magdalena, on this champagne. Ruckus, which is, do you know if the Commission is planning some kind of action, let's say challenge?
So from what they've told me, they're actually trying, they're going to challenge this, definitely. So what they told me is that they're going to check within the World Trade Organization whether Russia is actually violating any engagements it took towards the European Union, and if that is the case, they said they would take the necessary steps to change that. But I have no idea what these necessary steps might be, obviously.
That's a good question.
Okay, it's true that it's probably in breach of some kind of WTO rule, but at the same time, we're talking about a multilateral institution whose dispute settlement mechanism is completely frozen. I mean, and since 2019, basically the entire dispute settlement mechanism in WTO is paralyzed. So even these measures, in order to challenge on the WTO stage these Russian decisions, might be a bit tricky for the EU. So that's why probably it's better, to treat this bilaterally. But let's see, of course, what the development of this dispute could be.
I just have one comment on this whole thing. You said it was a bubble war. I think it needs to be a bubble battle.
Yeah. That's a good.
They're going into bubble battle. It just sounds so good. Bubble battle.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah.
That's my only contribution to this to this debate.
And actually, Magdalena, of course, stay with us to comment on this other news. There's also another battle with bubbles.
Another bubble battle.
Yeah, no, it's not really a bubble battle. When I wrote this article that you can find online on Euractiv.
Oh, a little plug there.
I used bubble of contention. Rather than, but
you don't need to explain that.
No. We're moving to a different kind of bubbles, the Prosecco bubbles. I mean, which one you prefer, Magdalena and Natasha? Champagne or Prosecco?
I'm more of a Prosecco girl.
Of course, because you're English.
Well, sorry. I have to say champagne, obviously.
Yeah, but you're obliged. Your audience will be shocked.
No pressure. I'm actually fine with both.
Yeah, okay. I'm actually not a huge bubbles fan. So this whole, conversation doesn't impact me deeply, but...
And coming back to the story, is a big complicated one. Every story, food related in Italy, is a bit complicated because they have this kind of devotion that sometimes becomes propaganda. No, so you need to discern.
No, said it, not me.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I can say that because I'm Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So basically, for instance, in Italy, the news was reported in a way that seems that Croatia is asking for the protection of the trademark of this, so basically the GIs, which the PDO, the Protected Denomination of Origin, for Prosecco, which is a sweet dessert wine produced in the southern area of Dalmatia. Okay, that's not true, because we're talking about the protection of traditional terms, which is a different framework. It's not in the GI's framework. So it doesn't have the same level of protection of PDO, so Protected Denomination of Origin, like, for instance, Chianti, Bordeaux. The traditional terms are intended to convey some information to consumers, like about a certain description of product characteristics. So... for instance, for French wine, the Vin des Pays or Grand Cru, or Ruby for Porto wines and so on. Now, the issue is that actually Croatia is well aware that they probably couldn't get the PDO status for Prosecco because of the evocation problem. So there was a landmark ruling in 2019 where the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, stated that the use of the literary character of Don Quixote de la Mancha for the promotion of a certain cheese somehow evoked the geographical area of the queso manchego, which is a cheese that got the PDO. So basically, for the mere association between this fictional character, this cheese couldn't basically use the character itself because it reminds of the queso manchego. So evocation really strong. You know, it gives you a taste again of how strong is the protection at your level of the geographic indication.
And it also, to me, I mean, listening to all of this, and just always, I said it before on the podcast, but it makes me kind of marvel at how food is so, I mean, it's so central to people's like cultural identity. Like it becomes so important to people, you know, like it's obviously to you as an Italian.
Identity, but also when it comes to wallets of people, because I mean, we're talking about a huge amount of money. We're talking about the added value, the reason why these products basically are paid double or three times a normal product. No, the point is that Prosecco and Prosecco are two different products. Like again, as I said, Prosecco is a sparkling wine, similar to champagne, but probably a bit better. No, I'm joking. While Prosecco is basically a sweet dessert wine, no bubbles, It seems more like Porto wine, you know, like
absolutely rien à voir.
Yeah, indeed, yeah, rien à voir. But the name is actually quite similar. And the real problem is that Prosecco in Croatian is Prosecco, but Prosecco in Slovenian is Prosek. And the PDO protect even the translation of a product. So basically the main issue is about the Slovenian translation of Prosecco. Because again, in Croatia...
So it's a language problem, not a...
Yeah, and that's why, for instance, Croatian winemakers they want to they're extending this olive branch to Italian, saying, you know, we can reach a compromise. We can add the adjective Dalmatian to the term Prosecco. So it's basically, you know, there's no way to mislead consumers. So in this sense, I mean, Croatians are right in highlighting the different composition of the different nature of the products. At the same time, Italians are right too when they say that Croatians are trying to bypass the GI's framework, because again, they're aware that they couldn't get this PDO, so they probably try to get at least the traditional term definition. For instance, the socialist MEP Paolo De Castro says that it might send a dangerous message that the protection of PDOs in the EU can easily be circumvented through a parallel scheme. In conclusion, I mean, it's a very weird war because it's fought within the EU.
At least Croatia is asking instead of just imposing its rule like Putin did.
Yeah, indeed. And it's actually because of the EU framework. I mean, for the EU, you know, forced cooperation that it's basically called European Union. It's true. And at the same time, basically, the EU laws are so strict that personally, I don't see a way to settle this dispute within the EU or within the, you know, after the Commission will basically rule something. Because, I mean, whatever the Commission will say, probably Italy or Croatia will go to the court and asking for a legal definition and so on. So maybe the better way to address this dispute is to find an agreement between the two governments involved.
Or to export Croatian bubble wine to Russia and sell it as
That's the perfect solution.
Yes, Magdalena. So just putting out all the fires here.
If you're doing a negotiation, hire Magdalena and we'll probably solve all your problems. And
you just got yourself a very lucrative side deal there.
So again, let's see how it goes. Of course, if the Commission decides to publish this application for objections, all interest parties have 2 months from the date of publication of the application to submit an objection, and then the Commission will analyze the objections and so on and take a final decision on the basis of all available information. So it's something that we will cover in the future too. So
watch the space.
Watch the space, indeed. And there was another important event this week, the launch of the Code of Conduct. The Code of Conduct is a part of the Farm to Fork strategy, which is the food component, the food system component of the European Green Deal, which is the flagship environmental policy of the European Commission. So what's this Code of Conduct? It's basically a voluntary initiative, which means that basically a company, organization, or NGOs who are among the signatories of this conduct, at the moment they have 65 signatories, they basically commit to certain actions which are considered good for sustainability, for a more sustainable food system. The most common commitments in this code of conduct are basically sustainable sourcing, the improvement of animal welfare, sugar reduction in products, cutting greenhouse gases, of course. Again, it's in between environmental sustainability, but also, let's say, health sustainability, you know, the improving the food products, even in with this, again, holistic approach, trying to touch on different aspects of the food system. So again, on board there are food manufacturers, retailers, food safe services, trade associations too. You know, it's a broad audience. Why it's interesting? It's interesting because of the particular way of drafting this code of conduct. As I said, it has been developed with the EU associations and companies. The Commission was acting as a facilitator, no? Not as a honest broker, but as a facilitator.
That was such a nerdy joke. I have to just point that out, how terrible
it was.
Okay. Continue.
It wasn't terrible.
No, it was a very good joke, but it was very niche. Nerdy. I like nerdy jokes.
Okay, listeners who think that this joke was terrible or nerdy, please...
It can be terrible and it can be terribly nerdy. They're not like mutually exclusive.
Anyway, yeah. Again, this code has been developed thanks to the companies, the associations, and of course the Commission will also support the implementation of the code. They had this stakeholders task force in order to lead the discussion, to adopt the main commitment. So it was an effort, not an innovative, because we had some kind of multi-stakeholder approach to policy making.
I was about to say that it sounded familiar.
You probably remember that this was the approach adopted for the original UTP, you know, coping with the unfair trade practices, before the Commission...
Before it didn't work, you mean?
At the beginning, the companies did some kind of code of conduct on unfair trade practices. It didn't work. And in the end, the Commission came up with a framework, a legislative framework, which was adopted in the last mandate. So again, it's not the best reference or the most promising reference. But again, there's no real way of controlling, you know, the implementation of these commitments. The Commission say it's a matter of credibility for companies to be transparent on this progress.
Presumably it was the same deal for
Again, some could say it's an exercise of corporate social responsibility, you know, in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, but at the same time, what Stella Kyriakides said at the launch event is that basically it's a beginning, you know, it's a way to start, it's a way to bring together the companies and try to propose and to set these commitments. And of course, I mean, presenting in the business environment the concept itself of food sustainability, which sometimes is a bit overlooked, let's say.
I suppose time will tell. And I suppose it will be our job to hold everyone to account.
It's also true that, for instance, I haven't seen a lot of reporting on this code of conduct. I probably read an article from Euronews, which was quite similar to the Commission press release, and then a lot of specialized media on agriculture and food. And
well, I suppose it will get more interesting as we understand how companies are actually changing and implementing, you know.
Also, but at the same time, I haven't read that much on media. But at the same time, I've received, you know, a flow of hundreds of press releases from companies, you know, saying we agree, we commit, and so on.
But this is what I mean. It only really gets interesting when you actually see the action that comes from it. You know, right now we've got everyone saying this is great, and you know what becomes interesting is when you try and match up actions to words.
That's true. I mean, again, there's this feeling that at the moment it's something really corporate, and even the importance is understood maybe just, you know, only by the companies, and there's no a lot of involvement of the media sector and even the public opinion. But again, let's see how it goes. This week, the AgriFood podcast is produced by Euractiv's AgriFood team, Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foot, with the technical support of Evi Chiori. This podcast is also available on all major streaming platforms, including Apple, Amazon, Stitcher, and Spotify.
Be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss the latest agricultural news from the EU. I'm Natasha Foot. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next week.